You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
People make promises all the time that they often don't mean or that they can't keep. But Victoria Lustolo never forgot the promise her father made to her when she was 8 to take her, his only child, on a glorious trip around the world. He was never able to keep his promise because he died of AIDS 3 years later. But Victoria did eventually make the trip herself, alone, perhaps as a way of helping him keep his promise, as a way of finding her father also, and as a way, ultimately, of finding herself. The result is a beautifully written memoir, a daughter's memoir, as she calls it in the subtitle. This Is How You Say Goodbye is published by St. Martin's Press, and I'm very pleased that Victoria Lustolo could join us now. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much.
Now you have two epigraphs. One is from Patti Smith, who wrote, "Grief starts to become indulgent, but if you transform it into remembrance, then you're magnifying the person you lost and also giving something of that person to other people." Was that an inspiration for you in writing this book?
It was, absolutely. I had already started doing some of the research and the interviews for the book when I read that quote in the New York Times, and it just struck me. It was sort of this light bulb moment. I hadn't been entirely sure what I was writing or what I was doing until I read that quote. And then I thought, oh my gosh, this is it. This is what I am aspiring to.
Well, did you know that when you set out on your round the world trip that you would ultimately record it as a memoir?
Yes and no. I think that was the hope. I had some idea that that was what I wanted to do. I didn't know if I was going to be able to pull it off. Either way, I knew I had to take the trip.
Well, it's not inexpensive.
It's not. It's definitely not. And I did actually have the book deal when I took the trip, which is the only way that I was able to do this. But even given that, I didn't know if ultimately it's a memoir. It's real life. It's fact. You can't manipulate those facts. So even though I was doing this and hoping that I was going, that something was going to come out of it that would be book worthy, there were no guarantees.
The second epigraph was written by your father in the winter of 1996, and it says, "Victoria, mysterious child, mix of my blood, will you turn out as wild?" It was scrawled on a scrap of paper. When did you find it?
I found that in a package that my mom had sent me with my father's day planner and some bills that he had. And just, it was kind of one of those boxes where I wasn't really sure what I was going to find. And it was tucked into the side pocket of his day planner, his date book. And there were a bunch of scraps and different notes, and he was always scribbling things down, so that didn't surprise me. But it did give me chills when I found it.
Well, why do you think he thought you might turn out wild?
I think that it had less to do with me and more to do with him. I was just a kid when he wrote that, and I was certainly at that time pretty much a goody-two-shoes. I think often when we think of other people or when we talk to other people, more often than not, maybe we're actually talking or thinking about ourselves. And I think he was projecting, and I was his child. In many ways, I was the only thing that he was really leaving behind, and I think he probably had a lot of questions about that legacy.
You start off the book with the admission that it took you a long time to learn how to smile. Why was that so difficult for you?
I think I was just incredibly self-conscious and insecure and didn't feel comfortable just being. I was very inhibited from a very early age.
And the opposite of wild.
The opposite of wild, absolutely, at least certainly as a small child. And it was hard to just, I think I was always second-guessing myself and doubting, that the validity, I guess, of my feelings.
Well, now you smile. How did you learn how
now
to do
I
it?
Now I definitely smile. I'm making up for lost time.
Is it something you had to train yourself to do?
Ironically, I think I had to train myself to let go, which seems like, you know, doesn't quite necessarily add up initially. But for me, I felt so constrained growing up and sort of walking on tiptoes through my childhood and navigating these complicated relationships that I was observing, you know, between my parents and other adults in this sort of very difficult environment when my dad was dying.
Was he a smiler?
He could be.
When you know you're going to die, it's hard to smile.
Yeah, it makes it a little more difficult. He also, his smiles could have an edge sometime too, which I think was something I had to learn the difference between those sort of edgy, sarcastic smiles and just a smile of pure joy.
What did he do for a living?
He was an architect.
And then your parents separated?
They did legally separate, although they never divorced.
And was the separation because he told your mother, who had been his wife for 14 years, that he was not only gay, but that he had tested positive for HIV on Mother's Day?
Mother's Day 1989, yeah. It was memorable, certainly for my mother. Yeah, absolutely, right? I mean, in part, that certainly led to the separation, although the legal separation was not immediate. It was almost a year later that they actually legally separated. I think, you know, when my father said that to my mother, you know, yes, obviously being gay when you're in a committed heterosexual marriage is a bit of a bomb, but he was also telling her that he was HIV positive, which was a death sentence at that time. And I think, at least initially, the disease really overshadowed the sexuality.
Well, if he hadn't tested HIV positive, do you think that he would have told her that he was gay?
You know, I think that's a very good question, and it's something I've actually thought a lot about. I suspect that at some point it would have come out. But I don't know when. You know, it could have been another decade.
Well, he had plenty of opportunities because they lived apart for much of the week. He lived near Santa Cruz where he worked and then joined you and your mother in Sacramento on the weekends.
That's correct. Yeah.
So there was none of those late night excuses. I'm working late at the office.
Right. And he had set it up to have that freedom. He took that job in the job. He was living in Santa Cruz. The job was actually in San Jose, and we were living in Sacramento. So it was a pretty complicated setup.
But why not just move you to Santa Cruz?
Right. Well, when he got the job offer when I was 6 months old, that's what my mom wanted to do and suggested. But he felt that my mom had a really good job in Sacramento. And, I mean, and of course, all of this was, I mean, my mother didn't realize it at the time, but he was orchestrating it such that he could sort of lead this double life.
Did your father ever tell you that he was gay, or were you just too young?
You know, both my parents were very upfront and open with me. There was never really we're going to sit down and have a big talk and reveal these things to you. It was just there and out there, and it would be sort of mentioned casually, and they told me things about my father's health and about his relationships much earlier than I could understand them fully. But I had the words and I had the language, and then over time I could make sense of that.
And then there was his deteriorating condition. How was that explained to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I hadn't, you know, they had told me that he was sick. That was something I pretty much grew up with. He contracted HIV when I was four. So I have no memory of not knowing that he was sick.
But HIV doesn't show up until
it presents itself as
full-blown AIDS.
That's correct. But they certainly laid the groundwork. I mean, I knew that it was out there and that he was unwell. And then as he got sicker, it was explained that he had full-blown AIDS. And again, I didn't necessarily know what that meant, but I very quickly saw what that meant.
And when were you able to piece all the things together?
Oh, I don't know, 5 minutes ago? I mean, certainly not as a kid. It was pretty overwhelming. It took a long time, years after my father's death, to really understand what had happened.
You tell of listening to a recording that you have of him at 21, only you didn't recognize the voice on the recording. He sounded different than you remembered him because he was ill?
You know, I'm not exactly sure why. I would imagine it was probably a combination of factors. He made the tape when he was 21 years old, living in Sweden, and he was just a kid. And I knew him, 20 years later in California when he was at the end of his life and he was dying and he was on a whole host of AIDS cocktails. So I think it could have been any number of different factors that sort of, at least in my mind, radically changed the sound of his voice.
It's hard knowing your parents, but especially so for Victoria Lustalo, who has written a memoir about finding her father and herself. It's called This Is How You Say Goodbye, published by St. Martin's Press. Was he already HIV positive when he proposed the trip to you?
Yes, he was. Mm-hmm.
So what do you think was going through his mind at the time? Did he realize it was probably improbable even then?
I'm sure on some level he did. In fact, I know he did, especially after talking to my mother and she said, "What? Are you out of your mind? You know, absolutely not. Are you taking our daughter out of school for a year and traveling around the world? You know, what if something happens to you? What if something happens to her? I don't want to be away from her for a year." I mean, a whole host of very rational objections. I think for him, it was that last bit of fantasy, that last thing that he wanted for himself and for me, and if he could somehow pull it off, he would.
Why did you both focus on three places in particular, Stockholm, Cambodia, and Paris? I understand Angkor Wat and Paris, Stockholm?
Well, it's funny. I actually really fell in love with Stockholm, which I wasn't necessarily expecting to. Stockholm is where my father had studied abroad when he was in college, and he lived there for a year, and that's where he made the tape recording. And someone that he had been dating actually came and visited him, and they traveled around, and they had a very special relationship. And that someone was actually an individual who I had the opportunity to know briefly as a kid later. And my father...
A man or a woman?
A man. Mm-hmm. And I had always known that Stockholm in Sweden had been a very important place to my father. I think it was the first time in his life when he could be free and he could be openly gay. He was so far away from home, and there was no Facebook, there was no Instagram, and you know, nobody knew what he was doing. And so it was really important to me to go back and find the dorm room where he lived, and I had a whole bunch of letters that he had written while he was there, and I had this tape recording, and so there was just a lot that he had held on to.
Now, had you held on to that promise that you would be taking this trip all the years after he died? How old was he when he died?
He was 44. He had just turned 44.
So young. Mm-hmm. And you say his death was a relief in many ways.
It was. It was no life that he had. I mean, he was bedridden there at the end, and he actually committed suicide. And I think for him, you know, he had died in many ways a long time before that, and he was just sort of waiting for his body to catch up. And for my mother and for myself, our whole lives had come to revolve around him and his sickness and his disease, and everything was sort of on hold, and he was in so much pain and so miserable, and we were just helpless. And so when he made that decision and you know, did take those pills and killed himself, he was free. He wasn't in pain anymore, and we were allowed to finally move forward.
And you say you went to Stockholm because that was an important place for him. Were you looking to find answers about him by taking this trip?
I was. I felt very strongly that when he was alive, I didn't really know him. And, you know, that could have been because he was sick. It could have been because he was on so many different drugs that impacted his personality. He was depressed. He was angry. I was also a kid. He was an adult. There's a limit there to the depth and intimacy a relationship can have, I think, in that dynamic. And I was very envious of all of the people who had known him when he was young and healthy and had adult relationships with him. And this trip was my way of trying to feel close to him for the first time.
And you were able to go to Angkor Wat only because it had recently been opened.
That's
after
right.
the terrible story of Cambodia, now Kampuchea.
Mm-hmm.
Did it turn out to be what you'd fantasized?
It was. It was a really it was really incredible. In fact, at one point in the book, I talk about how I hadn't realized that a small part of me wanted it to actually be a disappointment, because then it wouldn't have been so bad that my father never got to see this place that he wanted to see so badly. But it wasn't a disappointment, far from it.
You've done an event with Alicia Abbott, who wrote Fairyland about growing up with a bisexual father in San Francisco after her mother died when she was two. And then there's also a play now, a hit musical called Fun Home. Is it cathartic to know that other people have had similar experiences?
Oh, I think it's very telling that these stories are coming out now. I think that Alison Bechdel, who wrote Fun Home, the graphic memoir that the musical is based on, which the musical is fantastic. I got to see it on opening night, and it was incredible. And also Miss Abbott's book, is we are members of that sort of in-between generation of I might be more sort of in the thick of that than they are, but that idea of, at least for my father, the people who contracted HIV before my dad, for the most part, they died, and they died relatively quickly. And people who contracted HIV after my father, many of them are still alive today, and they are living with AIDS rather than dying from it. And my father was sort of that last group of individuals who, I think his life was somewhat prolonged by the AIDS cocktails, but he wasn't, even if he hadn't committed suicide, he probably wouldn't have made it another year. And so I spent the first half of my childhood seeing what sort of the AIDS of dying looked like up close and personal. And then the second half of my childhood after my father's death, seeing this whole new vision and life of what AIDS and HIV could mean for somebody. And so to have sort of one foot in each, and reconciling myself with that, and growing up with that duality, and now as an adult feeling like this is an important story to be shared. And so I think there is a time, and now is that moment for people to be talking about this, because it wasn't that long ago, and I think we've forgotten what it looked like.
You dedicated the book to your mother, and you reveal at the end that you took her to Paris for the first time. She was 62 at the time. Paris is always exciting to visit. But how has she responded to the book?
You know, it's interesting. I gave her a copy of the book many months before it was actually published. It was very important to me that she had the opportunity to read it, that she wasn't blindsided by it, and that if there was anything in there that I had gotten factually wrong or that she felt really uncomfortable with, that we had the opportunity to fix it, to discuss it. So she did read an early draft, which I think made her feel better. However, I think even after that, she was still somewhat apprehensive. But now that the book has come out, you know, I think it's made her something of a little bit of a mini celebrity in my hometown. And so I think she's really basking in the response from her friends and family.
People often wonder whether a book like this, a memoir, would be cathartic or healing. Has it been for you?
You know, it's interesting. I think for me, and, you know, I can only speak for myself, if I didn't already have some distance and some sense of closure and feel mostly healed about this story and this time in my life, I don't think I could have written a particularly good or at least decent, cohesive memoir. I think if you're still in the thick of it, that writing it down can be therapeutic, which is wonderful and serves a purpose, but a memoir is not a diary. It's not therapy. It is a crafted piece of narrative and art, and I think you do have to have some clarity. So I think I had already achieved a lot of that closure before starting to write it.
Can you explain your last name, Loustalot?
Well, it's French, so the last T is silent, so it's Loustalot, but I have I've spent, not quite a lifetime, but 28 years hearing all sorts of different pronunciations of my last name. And even friends of mine who have known me for years, we, you know, went to pick up tickets for a play and they were under my name. And I said, you know, Victoria Lustalo. And my friend of, you know, 6 years at the time turned to me, one of my best friends, and said, "That's how you say your last name?" So I now try and introduce myself with my first and last name so that people know how to say it.
Victoria Lustalo's memoir, This Is How You Say Goodbye, is published by St. Martin's Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.